headlines. Muslim countries conducting evacuations from Afghanistan are racing against time to meet an August 31st deadline, agreed with the Taliban. China accuses the U.S. of hiding behind rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its, quote, bullying, hegemonic behavior. And Iranian lawmakers debate the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for the first day. Thanks for joining us. An operation by U.S.-led foreign forces to pull out of Afghanistan is underway as the withdrawal deadline of August 31st looms. A NATO official says the evacuation is being conducted on a, quote, war footing at Kabul airport. The Taliban have warned the U.S. of consequences if the deadline is not met. The British Defense Minister, Ben Wallace, says Western countries are unlikely to extend the evacuation window. The comment comes as the U.S. military has advised President Joe Biden to decide soon whether to extend the process or not. Advisors have told the White House that the decision must be made by Tuesday to have enough time to pull out around 6,000 American personnel. Biden has already cautioned that American troops might stay beyond the deadline. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager during an attack on a refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank. Ahmad Hashash was shot dead during clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians in Balata refugee camp near Nablus. Troops attacked the camp in the early hours of Tuesday. Israeli soldiers frequently carry out overnight raids on Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. The raids often trigger protests by Palestinian residents and result in clashes with regime forces. In one such incident earlier this month, four Palestinian men were fatally shot in the Jenin refugee camp, also in the north of the West Bank. Tensions have run high across the occupied territories in recent months. Palestinians are outraged at Israel's settlement expansion and its crackdown on worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. A senior member of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that large-scale conflict with Israel is still on the table for the resistance front. Musa Abu Marzouk said it is natural for any nation suffering under occupation to work for its objectives. The member of Hamas's political bureau said Gaza is under the Israeli blockade and will try to break it. Abu Marzouk added that Hamas is okay with serious talks, but as far as they do not undermine the rights of the Palestinian nation. Resistance groups in Gaza have engaged in retaliatory rocket strikes against Israel over the past months. They say that is the only way forward to force the regime to end its aggression and lift the years-long blockade on Gaza. Activists from the British protest group Palestine Action have completely halted the activities of one branch of the Israeli arms firm Elbit Systems. They occupied the roof of the Oldham factory, refusing to come down until Israel stops attacking Palestinians and the arms company leaves their local town. Our UK correspondent Rob Carter managed to get to the location just hours after the action began to find out what's been happening.
Pro-Palestine activists in England have caused major disruption once again for Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems in Oldham on Monday, after members of the Palestine Action Group occupied one of Elbit's buildings in an attempt to halt the firm's activities. They arrived on location just hours after the stunt was launched.
This isn't the first time that this particular facility has been targeted by Palestine Action, and the group say that they will continue to target sites like this until there is a significant change for the Palestinian issue. Now, they have claimed that they have a long queue of future potential activists lining up to conduct this type of action, and that's because there are many, many people in the general public that feel as if they want to do more for Palestine, and they seem to have reached the conclusion that they have little alternative but to do radical action like what we see taking place in order to force the issue.
As well as occupying the roof, some activists blocked the main road, while others smashed windows before smearing the building in red paint. The colour symbolises the blood of Palestinians killed in Gaza.
These people are saying, here's pots of red paint, we want to stop arms. At some point in time, the arms trade will be as vilified as the slave trade was a couple of hundred years ago, and that's what we intend to achieve through this. Here, many people don't even know it's Elbit because it used to be called Ferranti. It doesn't have a big Elbit sign up. It should have a big sign saying Elbit, killer of Palestinian children. That's the sign it should have outside.
Due to the illegal nature of these protests, the activists will be arrested. Some already carted off as we arrived. The activists also risk fines, lengthy court battles, and possible jail time. Yet, they keep coming back.
No, Elbit is going to close this factory. I give you that as a promise. Elbit's profits are what we want to hit. Elbit as an organisation we want to hit. Elbit will go away because there is enough protest from the communities of this country outside of its factories to say, we do not want your bombs. We want to free Palestine.
Oldham's site is used to manufacture specialist military products, which have been used in successive Israeli attacks on Gaza. So, while Gaza remains besieged, Palestine Action vows to continue, as they put it, occupying the occupiers. Robert Carter, Oldham.
UN official has warned that 5 million Yemenis are one step away from famine. He has called for more aid from donors to avert famine in the impoverished nation. We earlier discussed the issue in our news review program with our guests.
It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator has warned that 5 million Yemenis are one step away from famine. Martin Griffiths called for increasing aid from donors to avert a famine in Yemen. He added that more than 20 million people in the impoverished nation need humanitarian assistance. Meanwhile, the UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes, including malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases. The UN has already said Yemen is experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has been caused by a Saudi-led war that began in March 2015 and a simultaneous blockade on the country. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them women and children. So joining us is Abdul Latif Al-Washali. He's our correspondent in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And we also have Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Abdul Latif, if I could start with you. Tell us about the latest situation in Yemen, the crisis unfolding there. What's the situation at Hodeidah port? Are the fuel tankers, have they been docked at the port? That's vital to the lives of Yemenis.
Thank you, Wissam. The humanitarian situation of the country is really catastrophic due to the main issue here, which is the blockade. The United Nations realizes that millions of Yemenis are on the brink of famine and they need assistance, as the world body said. But what Yemenis believe is that what the United Nations is doing is a clear mendicity. They are begging the donor countries on behalf of the Yemeni people. Yemenis say what they need is the blockade to be lifted and a real measures against the Saudi-led coalition to stop its deadly war, to lift the blockade. And Yemenis are able to manage themselves, and they don't need any more funds from the donor countries. They believe, Yemeni people, that the funds are for the operational expenses of the United Nations organizations. Most of the funds goes for the employees of the organizations, and what reaches the people in need is really nothing. They are nothing compared to what they get from these funds. So Yemeni people are asking the United Nations and the international community to take real measures against Saudi Arabia and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to lift the siege and stop asking on behalf of the Yemeni people for more funds.
Edward, so when you hear one Yemeni child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes as a result of aid not coming in, if that was one French child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, or one Canadian child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, or one American child or one British child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, will the aid then come and flow in?
Well, certainly, you know, if it was a white child, or, you know, from North America or somebody from Europe, there would be a much different response from the powerful Western countries. because it's Yemen. Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world, and it is, you know, not of concern, at least from a humanitarian point of view. The UN official, I think, described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. She should have added the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. So it's the blockade of Yemen that is the problem, which the Saudis and their allies, but also with help from the Americans and the British, have basically put in almost suffocating Yemen. They're only getting a tiny percentage of the fuel that they need. The World Health Organization has just canceled their medical program because, quote unquote, financial reasons. They're not getting the support. But, you know, the Hodeidah port could be open. If the Saudis are concerned about weapons and stuff coming through, the UN could monitor that and check it. But you need to open up the borders, allow food to enter, you know, from the Hodeidah port and any other port, but also from Oman and, you know, other places where, you know, the Sana'a airport could be opened up as well, especially for emergency medical reasons and for bringing in vaccines, bringing in other medical supplies which are urgently needed. So, yes, there's a double standard here. These are, you know, Arab, Muslim individuals, Shia for the most part. And, you know, the world actually, it just turns a deaf ear, especially the rich countries that are not interested, but actually are interested in making money by selling arms to Saudi Arabia and, of course, providing, you know, other military assistance. And, in fact, the British now have sent in troops into Yemen, which is very dangerous development. Britain used to have Yemen as a colony and trying to reestablish themselves there, and they're claiming that they're trying to hunt down the pirates, people who attacked an Israeli ship in the area. And, you know, this is possibly a false flag. They don't know who it is, or people trying to escalate the war and to create provocations or false flags to enable people to do that. So the British and even the American are looking for, you know, new places to wage war and to continue to fund its war machine. But the West, the United Nations, the rich countries are actually not even turning a deaf ear, but actually are supporting the aggressors and the Saudis here, who have, you know, there's what, over 20 million people on the verge of starvation, one child dying every 10 minutes. You've got millions on the verge of dying. And this is, you know, cruel, but it's a man-made crisis. There is, you know, no benefit other than that. I think the Saudis don't want to see a Shia government in Yemen, or a government that deals with the popular interests and looks after the people, as opposed to just, you know, the elite that is supported by the Saudis. So, you know, it's maybe that is the reason why the people of Saudi Arabia, the government there, is so opposed to Yemen being an independent state. The people are largely, they speak the same language, share the same religion, but there is still this fear of maybe an example that the people of Yemen could control their own fate, and that's something that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and that don't want that message or that example to succeed.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guest, Abdul Latif Al-Washari, is our correspondent, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And that wraps up this edition of the News Review.
Iran's parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a fourth day. Lawmakers are reviewing the qualifications of four picks on Raisi's list for ministerial posts. They have so far discussed 11 out of 19 nominees. Supporters and opponents of the candidates are given the stage to speak for or against them. The proposed ministers will also have the chance to present their plans and defend themselves. The four remaining ones will be discussed on Wednesday when a vote of confidence is set to take place. The Iranian president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement if any of the proposed ministers fail to win the vote. Raisi has said that his lineup is meant to bring about justice and progress. The Civil Aviation Organization of Iran has rejected media reports that a Ukrainian aircraft has been hijacked and taken to Iran. the organization's spokesman said that the aircraft took off from the airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul, on Monday. Mohammad Hassan Zeybakhsh added that the plane later refueled at the airport in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad. It then flew to Ukraine's capital, Kiev, and landed there on Monday night. Iranian aviation officials said that evidence of the plane landing in Kiev is available and will be published shortly. Ukraine has also said the information circulated by some media outlets on a hijacked Ukrainian plane is untrue. The foreign ministry said that there are no captured Ukrainian planes in Kabul or elsewhere. China has accused the U.S. of bullying and hegemonic behavior after Vice President Kamala Harris criticized Beijing over its policies in Asia.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The spokesman also said that Washington hides behind rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its practice. He cited the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan as an example of Washington's selfish foreign policy. Earlier on Tuesday, Kamala Harris accused Beijing of intimidating other nations. She made the remark during her visit to Southeast Asia. China and the U.S. have often traded barbs in the past months amid their differences on key issues such as trade and security. Anti-vaccination protesters in the U.K. have gathered around the building of one of the country's largest television news outlets to show their anger at the British media bias. The protest was held at the headquarters of the news broadcaster ITN in central London. The protesters said the mainstream media are not reporting on what they claim are the adverse effects of COVID-19 vaccines. At one point, a number of demonstrators entered the lobby of ITN building, but police forcibly removed them from there. The ITN said the abuse of journalists because of the reporting on the coronavirus is a worrying development. Britain has been one of the worst-hit European countries by the virus, with a record of over 131,000 deaths. Health officials say that the country's vaccination program has saved around 95,000 lives. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imam's extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads. Imam Hussein revolted to set a role model and he refused to surrender. He asked people to help him, and when a group of people from Kufa expressed their willingness to accompany him on this path, Imam Hussein accepted their offer and moved towards Kufa, and he did not give up in the middle of the way. Imam Hussein stood up against the deviated current of his time, which was extremely dangerous. And this became a lesson, and Imam Hussein himself makes the same point. That is to say, he backed up his action with the order of Islam. He said that his duty was what he was doing. He said that he had to express his opposition no matter what the consequences were. He said, it is good if my destiny is a victory and if my destiny is martyrdom. So much the better. This was how Imam Hussein acted. This was a perfect instance of self-sacrifice and it safeguarded Islam.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان أنا لاتشان
This move preserved Islam. This move institutionalized values in society. If Imam Hussein had not accepted this danger, if he had not made a move, if he had not taken action, if his blood had not been shed, if those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter, and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam Hussein did was an extraordinary feat. That is to say, the dimensions of his action are far more than what we estimate.
You've done. bomb.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning the Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough, even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money. And that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned a Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of this, much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening, and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN Climate Report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the West and South, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
Lebanon seems to be on the brink of an abyss as it grapples with a prolonged double crisis. Lebanon has been plagued by a political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, while a devastating economic meltdown has become an existential threat. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save the country. Lebanon has been without a government for a year now. The last government resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut. The financial crisis has seen the Lebanese pound sink by more than 90% and pushed more than half of the population into poverty. The Lebanese Central Bank recently scrapped a fuel subsidy due to lack of funds. Lebanon is right now suffering from a painful fuel shortage that has caused long lines at petrol stations and worsened blackouts. Last week, over 24 people were killed when a fuel tanker exploded as people scrambled to fill gasoline in plastic containers. There have been warnings that the fuel crisis may soon force hospitals, bakeries, and other essential facilities to shut down. The grave situation has become a serious threat to the nation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has begun acting in a bid to resolve the crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has warned against any effort to block the transfer of Iranian fuel to Lebanon. Nasrallah has warned Israel and the U.S. to stay away from ships carrying the much-needed fuel for Lebanon. The Hezbollah chief says the tankers coming to Lebanon from Iran are Lebanese territory. The resistance movement has been a key player in Lebanese politics for many years and has gained popularity for its stance against Israel. The movement is very much despised by the West, especially the U.S., which is the closest ally of Israel. Western countries have imposed sanctions on Lebanon in a bid to limit Hezbollah's influence. The sanctions have played a major role in triggering the current financial meltdown. The resistance movement's ongoing effort to ease economic hardship in Lebanon will probably improve the situation to some extent. But observers believe any effective solution for the crisis needs cooperation by all Lebanese political parties. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati expressed optimism that a government could soon be formed. But on Thursday, Aoun said certain parties are blocking the formation of a new cabinet to push the country into chaos. Lebanon seems to need a competent government more than anything else at this point. Any further delay in forming a new government could have devastating consequences.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili. And you're listening to IRIB English Radio and to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems, questions, and just issues that parents have regarding raising their children in an Islamic way. We stress, as always, that the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us today in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our overall topic for these last two programs is communication and how vital it is to raising a child. Today's topic is, of course, related to this communication, and it is being vague, or just vagueness, when instructing maybe, or just when speaking to children and ordering them to do this and don't do that without providing a reason or an explanation. They will say, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajum. Being vague, like you said, or just being general in a giving a piece of information, it creates a sense of, let's say, a fogginess in the mind of the child, that he doesn't know what's going on. Yeah, so he becomes uncertain of what you actually want from him, which in return he wouldn't do it. I don't know. I didn't get it. I don't get what you said. Or when you come and find him doing something not what you asked for, or at least not partly not what you asked for, you start to have a go at the child and look, I didn't get it. I didn't understand what you said. You said do this, but you didn't explain to me. So it creates that kind of fogginess when it comes to them trying to do what you want them to do. So, for example, saying don't leave your toys here. It might be very simple, but maybe to the mind of the child, it's like, okay, should I just take and just shove it under the table?
Yes.
Put them behind the couch? Or like just throw them anywhere else that you don't see them. Mm. So you just gave them a very vague instruction. But if you see the child, for example, take your toys, put them in your room, in your toy box, it becomes a very clear instruction to him. He takes his toys and he puts them where they want, what they're supposed to be. Or for example, you say to him, go clean your room. What am I supposed to clean? I could clean.
What should I clean?
Yeah, just I fix up my bed. Did you just brush things off? Well, no, you give them a specific instruction. For example, put your clothes where they belong, put your books where they belong, fix up your bed, put your toys where they belong, give your room a vacuum. So you give it a very specific instruction so that the child feels very safe, very comfortable in practicing and doing it.
Because you've also eliminated any chance of a misunderstanding happening.
Excellent.
In the child's mind.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So you, that's it. So you cleared the path for the child. Or, for example, if the child sitting in a gathering and he has his legs across or something, like, okay, sit properly. You know,
and then he will sit in another way, and that will also be improper.
Exactly. Exactly. So it creates another backlog. But if you say, look, put your feet on the floor, don't cross your legs, throw them on the floor, he understands.
This is the proper way to sit.
The proper way to sit. Excellent. So this is how we should begin with our kids when we're trying to explain to them. So always when we give orders and we give instructions, we have to be very clear, very detailed. I know with parents, obviously, as parents, we just want to get things done quicker because for whatever reason.
You know, it's but straightforward. Just sit properly.
Yeah, for you, it's straightforward. For me, it's straightforward because I know the right thing. But for the child, it's not. And this
exactly.
is, I think this is the mistake that we always make. We think that the children or even other people, they think like I think.
Yes.
Or they know things the way I know things. No, they don't. No, they don't. They don't think like me. They don't see things like me. So I have to be very clear.
You have
it.
Much more life experience than a child who's 4, 5, 7, 8 years old.
Exactly.
It's a vast, vast difference.
Yeah.
They say that I must unfortunately briefly interrupt our discussion because we are taking a quick break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen. Allah my Lord, His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him. I am a Muslim for all of time.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems that parents face when raising their children. We are just speaking about being vague and how it is detrimental and will lead to a communication breakdown when we are vague when we speak to our children. Dear Sayyid, please elaborate further.
So we said with children, it might work with the grown-ups more easier, but with children it doesn't work. So I could give you a general instruction, and because you have the prior details, so you can do what I'm asking you to do without having to emphasize or explain. But with kids, because they, as we say, they're plain, the brains are just plain slate, there's nothing into them. We need to always give them instructions and specific instructions of what to do. Otherwise, we're not going to get what we expect from the child. And the child's mind is just going to drift away and does what he wants rather than what she wants. And then you find parents, for example, coming to their children and saying, do it because I said so. Right? So it becomes like from an authority point of view,
very
or because I said it has to be done. You know, this also does not work. This is not a form of communication. So it needs to be, if you give them an order, for example, if you ask them to do something, explain to them why, and explain to them how it's done as well. Don't just the why, it's one thing. And you have to use a very clear, precise language, because children themselves, each child has a specific capacity to understand things. So my child might be slow as understanding things compared to another child, or he could be the opposite. Or I could have two children, for example. One of them, for example, understands very quickly. One is very slow and understands.
It varies.
Yeah, so it varies. So you need to treat each child depends on his level. So you speak to them in a very precise, very clear language that he understands.
Don't treat them in one strict way and expect the same results from every single one.
Exactly. So it has to be has to be taken into consideration, and has to be done in that simple manner that serves the brain or the child's ability to understand things. And we might even have to repeat our statement or repeat what we need them to do. Because
God forbid, some people hate repeating themselves.
No, as parents, most parents, we hate repeating ourselves, and we actually tell our kids, like, how many times have I told you this?
Yes.
That's what we keep telling them. How many times have I told you this? How many times? Well, as a child, he needs to be reminded constantly. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses this method in the Quran over and over.
He uses us to adults and people.
Yeah. So, for example, if you read Surah Al-Rahman, how many times does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala repeat the phrase, he keeps repeating it. I got it the first 5 times.
Right.
Why he has to keep like 30 times? It's just, sometimes we
to make
that.
Sure you get it.
Exactly. So you need that reminder. So you need to be more like open your heart and open your chest to your child and repeat things, because he needs it. He requires it throughout his life. And I think we mentioned this in another previous episode of why is it important to repeat things, because we said, obviously, it sinks in the brain of the child more often. So just don't give them instruction and expect them to learn it for the rest of their life. That's not going to work, because they will obviously, even as adults, we forget if we don't remind ourselves.
Do you say they must interrupt our discussion yet again, because we are going on a quick break.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Dear listeners, welcome back to our program, Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss relevant issues that parents face when raising their children. Today's topic is communication and vagueness in communication and how it can lead to misunderstanding and confusing the child. Dear Sayyid, please continue our discussion.
So far we were saying that a parent need to use a very subtle, easy to understand language. Obviously, repeat it more often. We said that the father needs, or the parent needs to explain to the child the purpose of why things are done. And these have to be always constant, and they have to keep, there has to be a repetitive a skill with the father, not just a one-time thing. And the other thing is, like, the parents need to make sure is that the child actually have understood. Because giving the instruction itself, or telling the child to do something itself, it does not mean or necessarily mean that the child actually understood it.
Right.
So sometimes, I don't know, maybe it would be a good thing to ask the child, did you understand what I'm saying? Should I repeat it again? Because even as a grown adult, sometimes when we're learning and studying, we ask the teacher to repeat things a few times. We ask them, like, I didn't get this. Could you please elaborate more? Could you please explain more? Could you give me more example? As adults, imagine that for a child whose brain is just very tiny and still in the developing process. So you have to make sure that the child has understood what you wanted him to do in the first place. Don't just throw the order and just expect the child to do it to the point.
It's not a computer.
Yeah, it's not a computer. It's not a robot. So that's not going to happen. And also the tone that is used to give the instruction. That's used to ask a child to do something has to be the appropriate tone for the appropriate order as well. For example, if something that let's say the child does something really bad and you want to make him refrain from an action, obviously you have to use a bit of, you know, a very strong tone, not like yelling or screaming at them, but he has to feel it in your tone that it's not a happy tone.
You need to convey the seriousness of the
exactly.
Situation.
So you have to use a tone in a way where you have to teach him that you're not happy with it. You're not going to use a very soft, loving, gentle tone like, oh, it's okay, nothing has happened.
Exactly.
You can't do that. So, and in a situation where he does something good, you don't say, oh, very well done. Thank you. Yep. No, obviously you need to use a very more subtle,
lighter tone.
Yeah, nice tone where he feels that love being conveyed to him through your tone as well, not
exactly.
Just... you know, just a plain tone, either one way or either the other way. So whatever he does or whatever she does, the child, you need to use the appropriate tone to explain to them
feedback
what
is
required
important.
To be done. For example, especially when we talk about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to children, I've seen this many times with parents. They, Allah will do this, Allah will do that to you. No. You know, Allah is love and peace.
Yes,
be
he's
more
merciful.
Yeah, be merciful. Use a nice tone.
Exactly. They say this has been a very fruitful discussion, but I must unfortunately end it because our time for the program today is up. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to